Good day, everyone. Welcome to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. To find out more about our upcoming shows or access to more than 1,600 podcast episodes, visit our website at www.biteradio.me. Today, my special guest is Kenneth J. Brenneman, author of Subversive Acts of Humanity, A Survival Guide for Choosing Evolution Over Self-Destruction in a World That Profits from Division, Exhaustion, and Quiet Compliance. Subversive Acts of Humanity is a rebellious survival guide for those who refuse to go numb. The systems around us are cracking politically, socially, ecologically. The old ways are failing, but what comes next is up to us. Blending primatology, neuroscience, and activism with humor and heart, this book introduces 16 bold, yet deeply human, acts of defiance, ways to break free from the forces that keep us small, reclaim our cognitive liberty, and build a more connected, resilient future. Ken is a writer, guide, and longtime practitioner working in the intersection of psychology, spirituality, and social evolution. For more than 20 years, his work has focused on helping people navigate periods of transition, uncertainty, and deep personal change. His background spans social work, psychotherapy, yoga therapy, and thanatology, the study of death and dying, which informs a grounded, compassionate, and deeply human approach to growth and resilience. For more information, you can visit his website, which is www.kenbrenneman.com, and that's KenBrenneman.com. Now that, I'd like to welcome Ken to the show. Good day, Ken.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Oh, my gosh, Robert, nice to meet you.
Well, I am really happy to have you here, and this is such an interesting topic. I am so glad to have had your book to read on my holiday vacation, and I really kind of got in tune with some of my little primate kind of Bean, so this is really going to be fun.
Did you find out what kind of ape you most resonate with on most days?
Well, and we're going to talk about that, but, okay. it does, there are certain days I feel maybe more chimpanzee, and I've had my orangutan days, but we'll talk about that shortly.
Okay, so, all right.
Okay, so first, tell us a little bit about your journey and mm-hmm. your interest in primates.
Yeah. So as early as I can remember, we all have this interesting origin story, but I was fascinated by apes. I was born in the late 60s in rural Pennsylvania, and I remember seeing the Planet of the Apes on TV. I was terrified that apes would be presented sort of as, like, for the most part, like the bad guys, right? And inevitably, my own personal evolution came to understand that, my first visit to a zoo, and way later in life, I got to go to Malaysia, Uganda. Each time I made contact with an ape, like in either in captivity or in their natural environment, I always felt like I was just getting a download from a really wise teacher. I turned the corner. I never became a vet. I just, hard sciences weren't my thing. You can tell time zone calculations are my thing. But I got to find out that, serving humanity, and as I got older, I'm now 56, I'm like, I have to think of us as just part of this bigger family of primates, of simians. And wow, does it just really enliven the work I get to do with individuals. So my first, nod at a self-help book was The Subversive Acts of Humanity. And I had a lot of fun writing ideas that come naturally through. working with individuals and groups. And so this interest in apes just kind of has resurged, and maybe we'll get to my future, but I'm excited to spend a month with orangutans in Borneo later on this year. And it's really enlivened what might otherwise be a time of existential despair or planetary grief. And I just want to acknowledge in that journey, my whole life, one of my teachers has always been Dr. Jane Goodall. And I recently got to write an article in the Brains magazine in Sweden that's available online. But I loved writing the title, I Ain't No Goodall. But when she died and she looked into the camera and spoke her last words to the public, I just felt a little fire under my butt and an ancestor nudging my shoulder and said, you can never step into anyone's footsteps or foot shoes, but you do have your own footsteps to make. So my earliest memory to my current fascination with apes just kind of has been a thread in my life.
Yeah. Well, you know, it seems that early on in life, we get a glimpse of what is going to maybe be our future passion or livelihood.
Yeah.
And I think it's wonderful. And you know, just a little shout out to parents, you know, pay attention to your kids, you know, what they're interested in, and, you know, because again, it could be their future.
That is such a great shout out. And I have to agree, like I've seen it all over the map where some parents just really hone in, like Jane Goodall's parent. She let her sleep with earthworms and let her hang out, but found out she's hanging out in chicken coops. Like that mother really like is an iconic version. My mom was somewhere near that where when she found out I was carrying earthworms in my pocket, she really kind of chastised me. But like Diane Fossey, who's a gorilla, you know, she was a mountain gorilla woman. And unfortunately, like her early life wasn't so easily understood. There's memoirs there. She spent a week of grieving her goldfish. I spent 3 days out of school because a robin I tried to help that had been orphaned died the next boarding. And I just missed school altogether. So you're right. We get glimpses of who we're going to become very early in life.
Yeah, and that's true. So now the book, Subversive Acts of Humanity, tell us a little bit about what you mean by subversive acts.
Yeah, it was much like yourself. I find myself channeling a lot of details. So this title landed in front of me during one of my deeper meditations. And I was like, I'm a pretty subversive person. I don't directly call out things, but I have a way to kind of nudge things in a certain way here or there. As a social worker in hospitals or whatnot, there's way you help to bring inspiration to wherever you are. And so I'm not as overt of an activist. I think of myself as kind of a quiet activist. And so let's give an example. Well, you know, when I lived in Japan is where I actually came out as a white-bodied American that wasn't actually a native resident there, but I loved being able to help others come out in their own way. They could only do it their way, but I could do it my way. And so I think I'm kind of my definition in the Urban Dictionary, Robert, I'd say subversive is kind of like a nudge, nudge, tag, you're it, and sort of help people kind of find just a little bit courage to do the right thing for them, to bring, you know, goodness to their spot in the world.
Yeah, you know, and I like the way you described your activities as quiet subversion, because I can relate to that. In hindsight, I could see some of my activities as being subversive, but it wasn't one of those screaming, yelling, and you know, kind of demanding attention kinds of acts. It was quiet. It was, and you know, that was just my style. And I think you know, for people who aren't the loud activist subversive types, it's good for them to recognize that they can do it in their own way.
Yes, right? That's maybe why it took me, I don't know when you wrote your first book, it took me many years to write a book, because who am I to tell someone how to do something? But as I meditated on this and the title came to me and the contents really were pretty straightforward. Like in my heart, they were so ready to be on a piece of paper, but it was like, I have no business ever, you know, informing other people how to do things. I do want people to, you know, think about what they're doing, how they're doing it, and not just go on our autopilot, because I think that's maybe the biggest grief I would experience, is that humanity doesn't take advantage of the supercomputer between our ears.
Yeah. You know, and what's interesting is that the idea of subversive acts, you know, that it's something that goes against the grain of maybe some generally accepted norms or that kind of thing. But it's,
yeah,
you know, the idea that it creates a ripple in a way.
Yeah. Well, and I speak of this kind of choosing evolution. I lovingly say this word, and I've tried to track who else has said this, but I think we're not Homo sapiens, we're Homo animus. We are soul-based, heart-based. And so, like, to help that sort of, you know, subversively remind each person every day, we kind of evolve a little bit, even though, you know, it might not be as dramatic, is the same to be said about the great apes. I mean, that's one of the reasons why they're greatly endangered, because they've had uninterrupted spaces in their part of the planet for many years. And so evolution is not only slow, but as humans, we're kind of conscious of that process. And that's where it gets really exciting.
Yeah. And you mentioned the Homo cordis, animus, the human of the soul. But you also mentioned Homo cordis, which is humans of the heart.
Yeah.
So do you see the evolution is involving both of those, or are they different paths, or?
Well, synchronistically, I'm currently reading a book, I don't remember the authors, but it's called Demonic Males, and it was a study of chimpanzees that sometimes you could relate to, right? And what's interesting is, you know, most scientists now look at humans as being sandwiched somewhere between chimpanzees and bonobos. And chimpanzees are kind of, you know, they're patriarchal. They can kind of be violent. And, you know, there's we don't want to romanticize that they've got it figured out, because they've had civil wars too. And then bonobos didn't really have the same encroachment of other kind of environmental or human factors. So they've evolved really peacefully. They're kind of, we call them the hippie chimps or the hippie apes, and they're patriarchal. So when you ask me about cordis heart or animus soul, I think both are happening. Even in my own household, like, I am so in my, like, spirit world sometimes, mm-hmm. too much so. And my partner is, like, he is a Vietnamese Buddhist monk, like, Thich Nhat Hanh times 1,000. Like, he's just in his heart so much. And I don't know that he necessarily follows me into the spiritual conversations, but he does really bring me into my heart. So I think both can happen.
Yeah. And... you know, that it's wonderful that you and Tim complement each other that way, you know, because it's you, I'm sure you each will influence people differently, and certain people will be drawn more toward you or him, you know, as far as being resonant with beliefs.
Right. So true. It's the most tangible case vignette that I have regarding my loose hypothesis of evolution of humanity.
Well, that's good. I just be proud that you're able to give a real life demonstration of the benefits.
Right.
So now you mentioned the bonobos and chimpanzees, and we talked a little about the gorilla and the orangutan. So can you know, these are like four very different types of animals or apes. And so can you tell us a little bit about each? Quite honestly, first of all, I had never heard of bonobos before.
Yep. Okay.
So, it's like, wow.
Yeah. Well, and maybe I will just start there because I think they are actually are, you know, again, we never want to put anyone or anything on a pedestal too high, but I think they're great relatives to model something that sometimes I think we're kind of struggling with. You know, there's so many of us humans, but we're trying to figure out how to, you know, coexist. And bonobos, you know, for a long time, I won't give dates, but, you know, we just thought that they were a type of chimpanzee. They called them pygmy chimpanzees for a while. And then once we could, you know, observe them in their native habitat, we realized just how differently they evolved to being where grooming or physical contact or even sexual or sensual kind of play, that becomes the main form of diffusing tension. And so sharing and sort of, you know, building that cohesion happens very differently when a matriarchal system with a very smart sentient being plays out. Now with chimpanzees, although they're both on the same continent of Africa, they've had to struggle with a little more environmental changes way back when, long before humans were impacting nature, but they do resolve things more through more territorial violence. And the alpha male works really hard to climb to the top and really has to fight hard to stay at the top. In fact, there's some stories by a primatologist, DeWall, that talks about when a not-so-sitting leader gets to the top of a chimpanzee community, that they don't stay in power very long. They resolve things pretty quickly. And one more thing I'll say about chimpanzees, and if you have a question about that hint of how, you know, poor leadership doesn't last a long time in the chimpanzee community.
Let's hope it plays out in real life.
All my opposable thumbs are crossed. And I think the beautiful thing that's been observed even with chimpanzees, where we think of them as a little bit more aggressive as a species, is the way that they do reconciliation has been observed. Now, I'll give one example that DeWall has watched, but there'd be a big scuffle. Two of the apes get in a fight. One literally bites the other's ankle, and then they break up the fight. The whole community kind of stays and watches until the two that were in the scuffle kind of reconcile. And the reconciliation goes like this. The one that kind of won by causing an injury, you know, tends to the injury, goes right back to the direct place of the wound. Mm-hmm. Now, again, this is in a longstanding community in captivity, but it's very interesting to think that the rest sort of watch and hold space while the two that got in the big fight figure it out. Again, I think it's a beautiful example that we can learn from close relatives.
That's a fascinating way of resolution. I mean, you know, I wouldn't have thought, you know, that the idea of tending to, quote, the loser's wounds would be, you know, a demonstration of hierarchy.
Right. Yes. And it would show that the winner knows that he's won. The loser isn't going to fight back again and is going to allow that, if they're not, one of them's not getting booted out or wasn't actually murdered in the fight, they're going to stay in the same community. So, you know, I don't know what chimpanzee language is for grudge, but almost, you know, they probably hold really tight memories. But I wonder if, you know, humans have this unique relationship to kind of grudge holding. It doesn't allow us to go back to the wound. more of pondering than having an answer for it.
Yeah, very interesting.
Yeah. We'll stay on Africa and just shift
sure.
to gorillas for a brief moment. They're actually the we see lowland gorillas in captivity, but there's a really sad story. If you ever visit Burundi or talk to the gorilla trackers, like, there are so many times where people would try to steal a baby mountain gorilla, and they are so adapted to their environment and their family that if you take them away, not a single mountain gorilla that we know of has ever lived outside of the mountain, you know, impenetrable forest or the place around Rwanda. So these mountain gorillas are really precious relatives to think of how important, you know, a pristine environment is. And this is another generalization, but one thing they see with lowland gorillas is they're not big tool users. Mm-hmm. But when they're in captivity, they become very resourceful with the objects they have. Now, my personal kind of telling of that is like, well, if you're evolved enough that you can get your food by reaching for it, you can rest in the grass and when you need it, like you don't need a tool. I think it's a really interesting thought experiment for us humans where I must have about 5,000 tools on one phone with all of my apps, right? Like how many tools does an ape need becomes kind of an interesting koan. Yeah.
So now, chimpanzees are more adept at tools, correct?
That seems to be so, both in observing them in their own home environment and in captivity, adept at using tools to get food for enrichment or play. Yeah, there are a lot of ways that you know, Jane Goodall's, people just didn't even want to post her initial findings. They're like, apes wouldn't use tools. We were very resistant to that in the 70s. So, yeah. Right, how does a wise ape use a tool?
Interesting. Yeah. And then the only other one we hadn't talked about is the orangutan.
Orangutan, yes, the people of the forest who are the most right now threatened because of human encroachment, but also weather. The one part of Borneo was hit by some severe rainfall earlier last year, and one of the three species of orangutan, where I think there's less than 1,000 out in the wild, they still don't have kind of a population count after that, you know, devastating flooding. So I feel very fortunate that I get to go in a short while to spend a month on the Malaysia side of Borneo and get to work at or volunteer at a sanctuary where I get to befriend them and just get to study with some primatologists. So I should have more information on the lone ape over in Asia.
Yeah, that's interesting. And from what I read about some of the strengths or, you know, the descriptors of orangutans, they were the great philosophers of the age, deep thinkers. And, you know, when I read that, I just couldn't help but go back to the Planet of the Apes because that orangutan, I mean, they nailed it as far as the type of, I guess, personality that right. One would have.
Right. Those archetypes are pretty, you know, that we didn't know that much back in the late 60s, and this was based on a book that was even earlier. Like, people really kind of went with something I would call almost somewhere between an intuition and an instinct to understand the nature of something. And if I could geek out on Planet of the Apes all day long. And one shout out for the parents with orangutans. And this is, you know, it's both sweet to watch if you ever get to watch a documentary on orangutans, or even get to see them in some of the zoos where new babies are being born, which is, you know, an important part of conservation. But one of the things that's amazing is how incredibly attentive the mom is. So like 7, sometimes up to 10 years, that baby is just getting fostered and nurtured. And if we're that closely related, again, you know, the amount of skinship and kindness we can give to the young humans so that they can understand the world and develop their senses.
I mean, that's fascinating. I think they're, you know, and boy, I bet you're excited to go on that that trip.
Well, yes, and I'm doing a little experiment with this, Robert. So my other interests in yoga and yoga therapy have to do with, you know, sound baths is a big part of my practices. And so I test ran through the Smithsonian and the Oakland Zoo. I've only got to ring singing bowls for one group of primates, the chimpanzees at Oakland Zoo. But we're taking, my yoga community raised $1,000. We're taking $1,000 worth of singing bowls there. Hopefully either the sanctuary or better yet, a local high school will adopt them. And if we can show this, that, you know, new arriving orphan orangutans or, you know, displaced apes and other animals, it might be a very ancient but easy to use a healing tool, because so far, everything I've seen, even this French guitarist who sings to all kinds of animals in the zoo, animals naturally, sentient beings respond to those, the way that we kind of send the good vibes out.
Yeah, well, that would be fascinating to see the reactions and how they take to that. So, good experiment.
Stay tuned.
Stay tuned. Yes, yeah, we'll have to have you back afterwards and really get the skinny on what happened. So,
well, I'm lucky because I'm a very very small voice in a big noisy world. But I did find a local filmmaker that we're going to make a mini film festival feature on this. I'm calling it Primates, Privilege, Possibility. So exploring how, small or big we feel in the world. What little things can we do? It goes back to the reason I wrote the book. But
wow, that's great. A little alliteration kind of helps with the title there.
Primates, Privilege, Possibility.
Yes, and actually, I mean, you can just imagine, what a trailer would look like, as far as, the good and the possibilities dangerous or, unexpected.
Yeah.
So, now, in your book, you have, as I mentioned in the introduction, 16 different bold yet human, deeply human acts of defiance, and I kind of would like to talk about just a couple of them, just to give the listener an idea of what's in the book. And now, chapter one was absolutely kind. You really like playing on words, don't you, there, Ken?
I'm not a father, but I got the dad joke. I don't know how it
works. There you go. So, Subversive Act 1, spread kindness through small, genuine acts of caring. That doesn't seem to be very subversive, does it?
Mm. We go back to this idea, and maybe I need to stop with the dad jokes and buy a dictionary. But, to me, when I go out in the world, I find, maybe Southwest Airlines flight attendant, but the average person that's working really hard, and it takes a lot to be kind. I mean, I go out into the world because I have, I get to work from home and I get to be of service to people that come to me, and I go out and I turn it up, and I'm like, I'm going to get that TSA agent to smile. Even if they start calling security on me, it's sort of a defiant act. Like, I know how hard you're working. I appreciate you, and I want to touch that place in you that's still human. And I know it's there.
Yeah. Well, no, that's good. The idea of, with the intent to, be, extra kind to someone who probably doesn't see a whole lot of kindness, or maybe even, the idea that sometimes their jobs are just very, very difficult.
Oof, right.
And just that recognition really does mean a lot.
Yeah. It's not a exercise here in that first chapter, but I just got back from a trip to Denver, and I found people incredibly kind there. I was like, I met my match. But I also, I enjoyed doing writing reviews. So after we went to a restaurant or a shop, I wrote probably 20 reviews on that trip, and I made it a point, I'm going to write those after I leave that shop and thank that person, remember their name. And it seems small. I don't know if you ever spent a day where someone didn't thank you, or you just kind of went and people kind of took you for granted. It wears you down.
Yeah.
So I do think it's sort of, a reminder to advocate for gentleness, for kindness when we can.
Yeah, I agree. And, whenever I am shown that, extra bit of kindness, it makes my day. It's like, thank you for recognizing me and how I helped you. Yeah. So definitely do, you know, spread some kindness, and I like your idea of making sure to do the reviews. You know, that's unfortunately all too often, you know, people will find themselves writing a review after a bad experience, you know, but
right.
but they, you know, just don't, you know, if it's a good experience, it's like, okay, you know, that's the way it should be. So, but then
yeah.
again, you know, it goes unnoticed.
Yeah. And actually, now that we're looking at this first chapter, Robert, I'm going to say that I actually do see, in hindsight, my other dad joke in the title. I love seeing the word kin in things. In fact, when people get all tussled about pronouns, I heard this argument that kin would make a great pronoun for everybody, because aren't we all family? Like,
yeah.
if we
mm-hmm.
really just put the kin back in our kindness, then we realize, like, we are trying to raise each other up, not press each other down.
Yeah. And I was born and raised in New York State, and then spent many years in California. And now, you know, the last dozen years or so, I've been here in South Carolina, and everybody's kin to everybody. So.
Right. So. And right. There's, you know, regional and local forms of that are pretty cool just to soak up. And I even heard your Carolinian drawl come out a little bit there as you said that.
Oh, no. Oh,
yay.
Excuse me. Yeah, I know the first time I said y'all and didn't realize I was saying it.
Nice.
I was devastated. But anyway.
Oh.
And also there's one part in that chapter that you reference Dr. Martha Beck's practice of KIST, self-talk. Boy, we are our worst critics. You know, having some that internal self-talk be kind can really reshape your attitude and perspective.
Yeah, and you and I are staying pretty earthbound in this conversation, but the neuroscience around, someone even quoted it as kind of like, you know, you cause your own little mini brain damage when you're that negative to yourself that long. Like, it changes how we see the world, how we not only see ourselves, but I mean, that kind internal self-talk is just, it's hard to coach someone to get that, but when they do. Did you ever see that YouTube video of a small child downhill skiing, and his father hooked up a camera and a little microphone?
No, I didn't.
It's the best version of a child, a human child, just going, I can do this. I got this. Like, he's talking to himself the whole way down the hill, not knowing that he's being recorded. It's so precious. So precious. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's really important. And then I want to kind of just talk about another one, you know, before we kind of go into a kind of a wrap up. The subversive act number two, disconnect from the human made world to rediscover your primal instincts and natural rhythm. And you called it rewilding. So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, the Japanese are known to be the ones that will prescribe forest bathing. There are those of us that live within a short walking distance to nature. I think even bringing nature into our homes and befriending plants or you know, something that really reminds, I've got some feathers, I'm looking at the wall, my feathers, and a couple of stones that my aunt gave me, like, How is it that we remind ourselves that we're part of nature, not separate from nature? And so the rewilding of the mind kind of comes when we think of that joke again, are we apart from or are we a part of? And it's even when we're away from it, like I was on a cruise ship a while back and I got to the 2 days at sea, even though you could see the ocean, feel really tiny. I got to feel really claustrophobic in a human-made world, and once we got off onto the next port, I was really quick to go to the greenest part of that small town. I just was like, oh, I kind of need that. So I think maybe, and that's maybe many of your guests and yourself too, this intuitive part just becomes kind of quote-unquote second nature when we realize that we're tending to, I'm an ape. I'm part of nature. Those sort of internal self-talk really kind of hone in what's important about that. I haven't worked in an office space for years, but I sometimes contract and go in as a yoga teacher, and I see when people kind of live under those fluorescent lights as opposed to more natural lighting. Like, there's many new initiatives to kind of make the space a little more humane.
Yeah, I remember those days. and you know, I too had gone on several cruises, so I know exactly what you're talking about. You know, the desire to, you know, put your feet on the ground and kind of feel part of the earth rather than floating on top of it.
Right. And it's, you know, I never mean, and sometimes my partner will caution me too, like, I get so excited about the possibilities. I never mean to disparage, like, oh gosh, I'm having a flashback to when I lived in this windowless, you know, basement apartment and couldn't even have houseplants there back in grad school. And I was like, there's no rewilding here. And I really did feel somewhat imprisoned by what was possible in my home environment. But boy, I think anything from those, you know, even guided meditations and envisioning nature, it can be done. You had a guest on about kind of the prisons and the prison effect. And I think, like, we can free ourselves and be in the wild, even if we can't naturally get there.
Yeah. And one of the things, you know, the part of that, the last part of that sentence about the natural rhythm, I think that, you know, we have such an artificial rhythm, you know, based on when the alarm clock goes off, you know, I mean, just the day-to-day types of activities that become so second nature that you don't even really think about them, you know, that it really, you know, takes us away from a natural kind of rhythm that we might have.
Right. And we teach each other how to tell time, but actually that's right. We kind of reinforce that concept. But if I've taken some time where I've been in Hawaii and I just get up with the sun and go to bed with the sun, and like, what a natural rhythm that becomes. It's not always possible in our hustle bustle world, but it is interesting to look at how it impacts us.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, just its effects on the body, you know, the circadian rhythm of, you know, of our being can be out of whack.
Very much so.
Wow. So what do you hope, you know, the readers are going to take away from reading your book?
Yes. Well, I hope that if someone picks this up, and I'm trying to get it into as many libraries and you know, free access, I'm hoping that it does have sort of a, what I would consider a pay it forward effect. Whenever I travel, I put them in the hostels that I stay, or I drop them off at cafes. It's kind of neat to think of, you know, just what's possible, even though I don't know the outcome of who gets a hold of the book and what they do with the book. But many of my friends, you know, they offered it out as a holiday gift, and that was kind of fun to see, you know, many more people in my circle having the book. But I hope it's one of those things that when you read through, like, you get to pick and choose. Like, you're the ape at this luscious, abundant fig tree. You might take the low-hanging fruit and really enjoy that. You might want to climb to the top and soak in the sun while one ripens. But I just think, like, the conversations that can happen over the straightforward journal prompts in the end, or the more challenging chapter on mortality, all of those really kind of just want to stoke a little bit of the, you don't have to get out there and yell at the top of your lungs. You might just do something really quietly in this next few minutes that changes your day and someone else's day.
Well, you know, that's wonderful. It really does plant seeds along the way for that kind of evolution.
Right. And if I can do a dark thought, which is another part of this book too, is like doing dark thought experiments, is while this past weekend I was away, I saw on my social media feed, because I didn't really read the news that often, that a new movie had come out, and it's called Primate. And I'm not necessarily, I don't want to have an opinion about it, but it worries me that the bad guy is a rabid chimpanzee that was kept as a pet. So however, whether there's teachable moments in it or not, I think what gets conveyed, and the zoo where I volunteer quickly came out with these, you know, this educational tool, be like, first of all, don't keep chimps as pets. Second of all, if something turns rabid, it may have a, you know, it's a sickness, not a horror movie hero.
Right.
It really reminded me of the conversations that need to keep taking place. Because our connection to our closest relatives is often through media, movies, and whatnot. I was disappointed that chimpanzees didn't sound like Roddy McDowall, but then I learned, right?
Oh, that's funny. Well, you know, and I can understand, you know, the concern, you know, because of Hollywood's portrayal of, I mean, from King Kong, you know.
Yep, yep.
On down, you know, the ape, you know, was always, always destructive and, you know, kind of always anti-human in a way. And, you know, that's just not the case. And in a way, you know, it does spark a conversation. So that in itself is good.
Yeah. And even the opening sort of playful mirror work, it's not necessarily that, you know, instantly comes to an answer or a clear-cut response, but it is an invitation, not just a glance at the mirror where you're checking your hair or brushing your teeth, but one can really gaze into your own eyes and see what's there. And wow, that mirror work is pretty profound.
Yes, it is. Well, Ken, I really enjoyed speaking with you. This was really a lot of fun, and I appreciate you taking the time to talk with us.
Well, thank you for having me on your radio show. And when I get back from Borneo, if I have a documentary I'll share with you, I hope you'll watch it.
Absolutely. And still, I'm going to, you know, connect on social media so I can still follow the journey, because it's really fascinating.
Well, thanks. And thanks for sharing my website and social media. I really appreciate people being able to engage in this conversation. It can be fun. It can be evolutionary.
Absolutely. That's great. Okay, everyone, again today, my special guest has been Kenneth J. Brenneman, author of Subversive Acts of Humanity, A Survival Guide for Choosing Evolution Over Self-Destruction. And again, you can find out more by visiting his website, which is www.kenbrenneman.com. And that's KenBrenneman.com. And in closing, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.